Hello and Happy New Year. Welcome to this mini episode of the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. This is Chris, back from what was an unintended hiatus. This week I'll be discussing a story from one of the briefer of heroes that we've covered, Firebrand. Well, he isn't all that brief considering, but his initial run was, we'll get into that. Firebrand was another creation of artist Reed Crandall and writer Jerry Iger. Crandall we've previously discussed in our episodes covering The Ray, Dollman, and Blackhawk. Iger we've previously touched on for his involvement with Quality characters and for being the other half of the Eisner-Iger studio. Firebrand was first introduced in Police Comics No. 1 from August 1941. The issue was also the first appearance of two Quality characters Mike and I have bumped into, Plastic Man and Phantom Lady, as well as other characters such as 711, the Human Bomb, Steel Kerrigan, and the Mouthpiece. Firebrand was the secret alias of millionaire playboy Rod Reilly, who had grown bored of his lifestyle and wanted to begin fighting crime, a trope that pops up in a lot of comics, it seems. Rather than seeking ancient teachings or spending years training in the mountains of a remote region of the world, Rod turned to his friend and former prize fighter Slugger Dunn for help in getting himself in peak physical shape. Donning a red mask that covered and wrapped his head like Zorro, a pair of tight red pants and boots, and a lariat, Firebrand was born, bare-chested and ready to fight. Nazis, mostly, because of the time and because they frequently seemed to scheme in the wealthy circles of New York City. Nazis. He also left a calling card, a flaming torch. Other notable characters included Rod's father, Emerald Ed Reilly, and Rod's fiancée, Joan Rogers. The history of Firebrand gets confusing with the absorption of Quality into DC. Firebrand, of course, then became a property of DC Comics, but one that they didn't do much with, at least the Rod Reilly version of the character. The later incarnations, two of which have no relation to Rod Reilly, all involve powered or metahuman characters. The one that is possibly most familiar to audiences due to her appearances in various media and hanging around for nearly 20 years is Danette Reilly, who was originally Rod's sister. In her origin, after Rod was injured in the attack on Pearl Harbor, she took up the mantle of Firebrand, in part due to her powers that allowed her to control fire. She joined the All-Star Squadron and married Shining Knight, and later went on to serve a role in Crisis on Infinite Earths. After the Seven Soldiers of Victory became lost in time, Danette fought Dragon King and was killed in a flashback in Stars and Stripe No. 12 in July of 2000. Danette also became part of the Young Justice continuity, where it was revealed that she was actually a creation of Tio Morrow, a more advanced android than Red Tornado or Red Torpedo. She overcame her programming and died a hero at the hands of Dragon King, but was later reactivated as Red Inferno. Using the three Reds' consciousnesses, Red Volcano was created but ultimately defeated when Red Tornado convinced Torpedo and Inferno to help him. In the process, Torpedo and Inferno perished. In the end, while the Rod Reilly character lives on in name, he only appeared in just over a dozen books, leaving behind his alter ego to be used as DC seems fit. Today's story, though, is from Police Comics No. 9, from May of 1942. The cover shows Plastic Man stretching his head and neck to knock out a bad guy. And I'll note, because of how close we are to Christmas, the inside cover does feature a mail-away prize offer for American Seed Company, the top prize being a Daisy Red Ryder rifle. As you know, that's a dangerous gun. You'll shoot your eye out. We start with a great splash of Firebrand knocking out some Nazis in front of what appears to be the sun from the Japanese flag. This is a common thing that runs through a lot of his stories. He's being tackled by a Japanese officer, but this doesn't stop Firebrand from manhandling three Nazis at once behind a large banner that carries his name. Jumping into the story, it's New Year's Eve at Jones, and the party is in full swing. A man named Maxwell, the inventor of a perfected gun sight, is in attendance and wants to show his plans to Emerald Ed Reilly. Rod and Slugger arrive, but don't catch the butler spying on Maxwell and Emerald Ed. The butler grabs his Nazi accomplices, and they knock the men out and steal the plans. The clock strikes midnight, and everyone celebrates. Rod beckons the strangers at the party to celebrate and toast with him, but Joan hears a moan that sounds like her father, and Rod rushes away. He realizes the strangers must have been responsible and chases after them, stripping to his Firebrand costume and leaping on his motorcycle. They are slowed in Times Square by the crowds, and Firebrand is able to catch up on foot, dragging them from their car. As he fights the men, the cops arrive and break it up. As they try to subdue Firebrand, he explains the men were Nazis and that he's Firebrand. The cops realize they've made a mistake, but it's too late, as the men have escaped. Back at Jones, Rod finds that Joan and Slugger have trailed the butler to find clues. At a movie, they see the butler slip the blueprints to another man and decide to follow him. He leads them to a warehouse on the docks. On their way in, Slugger kicks a can by mistake, which is enough to alert the Nazi agents. Joan and Slugger are tied by their necks, standing atop wax pillars that will melt by the heat of a nearby stove. The Nazis leave, and Firebrand bursts in, noting their location because of Joan's car parked outside. Which probably wasn't the best idea for Joan and Slugger, but they're not, you know, as stealthy. He unties Joan and Slugger and makes his way to the Nazis' getaway boat, which is having some trouble starting. Slugger and Firebrand jump aboard and beat the men senseless. After they're unconscious, Firebrand dumps the men in Joan's back seat and tells her and Slugger to drop them off at the nearest police station. Later at Jones, she finds Rod and asks him where he's been. He explains he was out getting the cops and missed all the action. She falls into Rod's arms, telling him how wonderful Firebrand is, as he and Slugger exchange a knowing smile. Which, Slugger seems to have some boundary issues. He's real close on that hug, but you know, they're good friends. So this was a fun short story. I found it by looking up New Year's stories from Golden Age books, and thought perhaps that the whole New Year's angle might factor in a little bit more. But oh well. The art and dialogue made the whole thing fun. There were some cool angles that Crandall was able to get in there, which I thought was really cool. Like during the hanging scene, there's almost like a Dutch tilt to it. I figure it's probably because of the way that he was trying to fit the panel in and show that they're being hanged, but. It was really cool. It was from a really cool angle, and I really appreciate the way that he was able to work that out. But the art and the dialogue, it didn't feel too deep. It was engaging enough and fast paced enough for a short 6-page story. If you've been reading up to this point, you've already got 8 Firebrand stories behind you, so you don't need any real backstory, but even still, you get a decent enough snapshot of his abilities and who the other supporting characters are without leaving too many questions or feeling like things don't make sense. Overall, I'd be interested in reading the rest of these, which appear to have been collected at a reasonable price by Guandanaland Comics, who seem to have collected a lot of public domain stories into their own books. The two hang-ups I do have with this Firebrand tale have to do with the location, New York City. First, Firebrand is bare-chested, and it's December 31st. So December 31st of almost any year in New York City is frigid, but maybe his adrenaline is pumping and has made him disregard that it's around freezing. But the other hang-up is that the Nazis decide to cut through Times Square, which might be because they're unfamiliar with American customs, but even still, they could have seen that crowd, which those possibly smaller than today's crowds, was still formidable in the 1940s. They could have seen that crowd from blocks away. So driving into the crowd, not the smartest of ideas, but if Indiana Jones movies have taught me anything, it's that Nazis don't always think things through to their logical conclusion. So that'll do it for this week. Short episode, but apologies for the schedule we've been keeping. There's been a lot going on for both of us, and we're hoping to get things back to normal very soon. As always, you can check us out through Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and at our website, comicsinthegoldenage.com. We're also part of the Comics Podcast Network at comicspodcast.com. And Michael stays active through our Facebook and our Twitter. That's Comics in the GA is our handle. And you can also get to us through Gmail if you have any questions or suggestions. That's comicsinthega@gmail.com. So that'll do it for this one. We'll be back very soon. Thanks again for listening, and Happy New Year.